Welcome to another busy edition of Radio EcoShock. I'm your audio slave, Alex Smith. But first, let's cram in two interviews from Greenpeace, and it's all about the real cost of everything you eat. If we arrived on Earth from space for the first time, the biggest visible changes by any species would not be the cities or the roads, but the vast expanses of land diverted to agriculture. Now Greenpeace says modern industrial farming has risen past the land surface to change the very atmosphere of the planet. We clear away forests, which used to grab carbon dioxide out of the air. We grow billions of sheep and cattle, leading to bursts of methane. And now, with industrial agriculture, we spread oil-based fertilizers that emit streams of the most powerful greenhouse gas, nitrous oxide.
This icy wilderness is under threat, and it's not just here. Apparently, the whole planet is in danger from man-made global warming.
The report is called Cool Farming: Climate Impacts of Agriculture and Mitigation Potential. It's from Greenpeace International. We have with us one of the authors, Dr. Pete Smith, from the School of Biological Sciences at the University of Aberdeen. Dr. Smith was also a lead author, reporting for last year's climate series from the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. Now, Pete, the total amounts of greenhouse gases coming from human agriculture were surprising to me. Your report finds that farming contributes at least 20%, maybe even up to a third of all the human-made greenhouse gases. Can you put this in context so the average person can get a handle on what this means?
Yeah, I mean, this is we're mainly talking about non-CO2 greenhouse gases when we're looking at that. So CO2, carbon dioxide, is the main greenhouse gas, and most of that comes from fossil fuel combustion. But some of the other greenhouse gases, for example, methane and nitrous oxide, a large proportion of those is made up by agriculture.
And, you know, James Hansen, the U.S. scientist, was talking about how important it would be to control methane, and a lot of people didn't really pick up on that message. We've had so much in the press about carbon dioxide and carbon dioxide.
Yeah, that's right, yeah. Well, methane is about 23 times more potent than carbon dioxide. And nitrous oxide, the other gas, the other non-CO2 greenhouse gas that's important in agriculture, is nearly 300 times more potent than carbon dioxide. So although they're emitted in smaller quantities, we do need to keep close tabs on them, because they're much more powerful in terms of the impact that they have on the climate.
Well, that's one of the things I'd like to focus on, is nitrogen dioxide. I was surprised again about the amount coming out of fertilizer. I knew that making it used a fossil fuel and we'd get some releases there, but how does it get out once it gets to the fields? How does that get into the air and change the climate?
Yeah, okay. Well, what happens is nitrogen is one of the main components of mineral fertilizers, and it's used to increase productivity and to increase crop production. We rely on it. We wouldn't be able to feed the 6 billion people that we have on the planet now and the 9 billion people that are projected to be on the planet within the next century if we didn't use nitrogen. So it's not something that we can just immediately stop using. But what happens is the nitrogen in the fertilizer is applied to the soil. If the practice is very good and the nitrogen is applied at the right time, just when the crop needs it, then most of that nitrogen goes into the plant where it's required for growth. But what happens if it's applied at an inappropriate time, or if you're just unlucky and you have a significant rainfall event after the fertilizer has been applied, is that some of that nitrogen undergoes what's called denitrification. So that's just a change within from the mineral nitrate. It's part of the natural cycle of nitrogen, and as part of that denitrification process, which would normally produce dinitrogen gas, so that's just normal nitrogen that makes up most of the atmosphere, that's inert. Sometimes it doesn't go all the way to nitrogen, especially where the conditions are anaerobic or where there's a lack of oxygen. So if you've got waterlogged soils, for example, you can have a lack of oxygen, which means that you only get partial denitrification, which then leads to the release of nitrous oxide. So it's just part of the natural cycle of nitrogen, and any nitrogen that's around in the environment undergoes this denitrification process. But when we're putting on maybe, 100 or a couple of hundred kilograms of nitrogen per hectare in addition to what's already there in the environment, then we're obviously increasing the risk of nitrous oxide emissions from the soils.
And can some of it also come from the manure of farm animals?
Yeah, some of it can come from the manure, yeah. So just switching from mineral fertilizer to animal manures is not, you know, it's not going to solve the problem, because we have nitrogen available in organic material within the manure. That's then mineralized to nitrate, and it's then available for denitrification in exactly the same way as mineral nitrogen is. So it's a problem, you know, the way to address it is through best management practices to make sure that the fertilizer's on there just when it's needed, and not on there when it's not needed, and not when it's at risk from being lost as nitrous oxide.
And how long does the nitrous oxide stay up there?
Well, the nitrous oxide has got, how long does it stay in the atmosphere?
Yeah.
Well, it's got half-life, just like any of the other greenhouse gases. Methane has a shorter half-life, so that's relatively quick into the atmosphere and is relatively quickly oxidized. But nitrous oxide can stick around for a while in the atmosphere. So when that's emitted, part of the large global warming potential is the fact that it sticks around in the atmosphere for a relatively long time.
Well, about 10 years or 100 years or?
Well, it decays. So you'd sort of describe it with a half-life. But whereas half of your methane would maybe be gone in 10 years, your nitrous oxide would be sticking around for longer than that, you know, maybe decades.
Well, that leads into the second thing that I really wanted to have a look at, and that's the impact of meat animals, especially cows, that have on our climate. Back in 2001, the FAO reckoned there were at least 1.5 billion cattle on the planet, and even more billions of sheep and goats. How do farm animals help heat up the planet?
Well, farm animals, there are two ways, I guess. The first way is that through direct emissions. So that animals, especially ruminants, you know, animals that have a rumen, that is one of these four-chambered stomachs that you know, like cows or cattle have these four-chambered stomachs. These are very good at digesting grass. You know, they can digest material that we as humans can't digest. But a byproduct of having that four-chambered stomach is that there's quite a lot of methane produced in the decomposition. So it's all anaerobic in there. There's not much oxygen kicking around within the stomach. And then when the carbon substrate, or any, you know, that's basically the food, is decomposed, then methane is produced. So that methane is then emitted from the cows or any other ruminant, in fact, and goes up into the atmosphere. And that's quite a significant contribution to atmospheric methane for livestock. You've got secondary sources in the manure. So because the manure is also wet, and you have anaerobic decomposition going on within the manure, you can emit methane from the manure. And the other thing that contributes is that whereas animals are only, say, 10 or 15% efficient in converting the food into body mass, as we are, you know, all animals have a very limited efficiency. If we feed animals the grain products, which then, you know, increase their body mass, and we then consume the body mass of the animal, it's going through sort of two very inefficient stages. There's the inefficiency of us in converting that meat to our body mass, on top of the inefficiency of the animals converting their body mass from the grain. So just cutting out that middle section by consuming less meat and eating more, you know, direct vegetable products, you know, grain and cereals and such like, actually increases the overall efficiency of the system. So per unit of fossil fuel energy that you go into producing, a kilogram of meat, you've got much less greenhouse gases emitted if you for a kilogram of grain or cereal.
So just go direct to the source and eat the grain itself without the intermediaries of the meat process.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, it's in terms of greenhouse gases, that's a much more efficient way to operate. So in terms of, if you were just looking at it from the point of view of greenhouse gases, then we would all become vegetarian. But of course, that's not the only consideration. We've got lots of cultural and other things that determine, you know, as well as just the, you know, as well as people just like eating meat, that determine how much meat we eat. And in fact, the projections are that as the developing world becomes richer, the proportion of meat in the diet in the developing countries will go up. So we're actually projected over the next 20 or so years to increase the amount of livestock that we have on the planet.
Wow, that's a little frightening to me. And I know the fisheries resources are becoming depleted too. So billions of people may turn to raising land animals for protein. Is there a way to do this without rearranging our climate?
Well, yeah, I mean, there is. There are good management practices which can be used and have been used and are being used in various parts of North America. For example, where land has been degraded, you have situations, you know, where the organic matter has been lost from the soil. So putting livestock onto these systems, putting grass on and then putting livestock onto the grass and rotating it, so rotating the animal so that it's not overgrazed, can actually increase the amount of carbon that's in the soil. So in our research, we've looked at a whole range of measures, and one of the most effective methods of increasing the organic carbon stock of the soil, so that's taking carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere, you know, one of these other greenhouse gases, is to use improved grassland management. So by being clever, I mean, none of this is rocket science, and a lot of this is known to farmers and known to extension agencies that are helping the farmers to make the decisions. We know this already, and most of it is consistent with good practice. So what we need to do is we need to identify ways in which we can continue our agriculture, because we need to feed a growing population, but to do that in a smart way so that we both minimize the amount of greenhouse gases that we emit, whilst also, you know, reducing the waste and the inefficiency that we have in the system currently. And that can also, of course, help to improve profitability. So we're looking to, you know, we need to look at ways of improving all of these different things in, you know, what sometimes term win-win situations, so that we improve productivity and at the same time we reduce the losses and the emissions of greenhouse gases.
Well, you know, historically the UK has been part of the development of agriculture, and I'm wondering, are you aware of climate-friendly farming experiments going on in Europe?
Yeah, I mean, there are a lot of the things where we've looked at what policies within Europe, in fact, globally. If you look globally, most of the policies that are driving climate-friendly farming aren't actually anything to do with climate change. They're to do with improving the efficiency of the farming systems, to do with reducing waste and reducing fossil fuel inputs, and to do with reducing other forms of pollution. So, for example, in the UK, we have a number of areas, as I guess you do in Canada, that are nitrate vulnerable. So that's where if you put on too much nitrogen fertilizer, some of that nitrogen can get washed out into the water courses, which then causes algal blooms in the rivers, which furs up the rivers and kills the fish because it takes out the oxygen in a process that's known as eutrophication. So a lot of the efforts that have been put in the UK has been to reduce this nitrate pollution in the water courses, but what that has meant is that means that the timing of the fertilizer applications, the amount of the fertilizer that's put on is calculated to be just right so that you're not over fertilizing. So all of these things that were originally intended to reduce nitrate leaching are also helping to reduce nitrous oxide emissions. So really just managing our farmland in a smarter way is a way to reduce greenhouse gas emissions, and it also helps to, you know, it has co-benefits with respect to lots of other aspects of environmental pollution and improved efficiency.
Well, and we could save on some of the fossil fuels and all the worries that depending on fossil fuels bring us. We haven't touched yet on the other large factor, which is converting more and more land to agriculture. Can you tell us how this is going?
Yeah. Well, in the developing world, there is still conversion of native ecosystems. So some of that's forestry, and some of that is, you know, other native ecosystems like the Brazilian Cerrado, for example. So those native ecosystems are still being converted to agriculture because there's a demand for agricultural products. So that's happening. Because we need to feed 6 billion people at the moment, and that's projected to increase to 9 billion people, we need to be really clever in the way that we produce the products. So whilst the population has increased greatly over the last 100 or so years, so has crop productivity. So whilst, you know, if we had a population of 9 billion and we maintained the same levels of productivity that we have now in most of the developing world, we'd need to spread out into, you know, really, really widely. So cropland would spread over huge areas. So in order to avoid having to spread into those native areas, you know, which is also bad for carbon loss, greenhouse gas emissions, as well as loss of biodiversity, cultural heritage, and all those other things, we need to minimize the amount of agricultural land that we use. So it's really a delicate balance between, on the one hand, avoiding the pressure on other land. So we need to keep our cropland and our agricultural land maintained more or less within its present boundaries. And to do that, we need to increase the productivity per unit area of land. And we need to balance that against the need to reduce the inputs or to improve the efficiency of the system so that we're not wasting, so that we're not wasting energy, fossil fuels, and causing greenhouse gas emissions on that land. So that's the balance that we have to strike. We can't just go to non-intensive farming because that would put pressure on all of the other native ecosystems, and we can't just go to, you know, hardcore, really, really intensive farming because that would be bad in terms of energy and greenhouse gases. So we need to find that middle way, and that's the challenge for us in the future.
Well, as you know very well, one reason people are bulldozing some tropical forests is to grow palm oil or soy, destined for our gas tanks as so-called biofuel. And I want to refer our listeners to a study done by Paul Crutzen at the Max Planck Institute, along with a whole group of international scientists, and it was called Nitrogen Dioxide Release from Agro-Biofuel Production Negates Global Warming Reduction by Replacing Fossil Fuels.
Yeah.
And that was published August 1st, 2007.
Yeah, I read it.
Yeah, I'm sure you have. And that study finds that the process of growing biofuels creates so much nitrogen dioxide as a powerful greenhouse gas, we actually add to global heating when we try and use so-called green biofuels. Would you agree with that?
It depends. It really does depend on how you're doing it. It depends on how you're doing it, where you're doing it, and what form of land use you're replacing. So I wouldn't say that on a blanket basis that producing biofuels is necessarily an environmentally bad thing. But there are good ways of doing it and there are bad ways of doing it. And if you have to over-fertilize, if you have to put huge amounts of nitrogen on to get that material out, then of course you are going to end up in a situation where you wipe out, you know, it negates the benefit as is suggested in that paper. But there are situations where we can use bioenergy. This is maybe not for biofuels, but for, you know, if we're burning the biomass directly, so for example growing trees or these very quick-growing grasses from Southeast Asia like Miscanthus, if we can grow those sorts of energy crops and use those to generate energy, you actually get a very significant climate benefit because they require very little fertilization, and you can use the energy that you generate from those areas of land to substitute for fossil fuels. So it's a very complicated situation, and it really depends upon all of the different management practices. But what's really clear from that study is that we can't just say this is the end product that we've produced, it's a unit of ethanol or it's a unit of biodiesel or one of these other biofuels, and that will substitute for fossil fuel, so that's all we need to think about. We need to do a full life cycle analysis on the production of those biofuels and look at all of the fertilizer inputs, the energy inputs that goes into getting the energy out, and then compare that to the alternatives of fossil fuel. And it's only when you have a net benefit, when you take into account all of those things, that biofuels make sense. And in some cases they do make sense, quite clearly, and in some cases, as has been highlighted in that study, it doesn't make sense.
So we may need some sort of certification process.
Yes, that's right, yeah. I mean, there are movements afoot to try and certify, you know, to try and come up with frameworks anyway for biofuel certification. So, you know, where it's come from, in the same way as I guess you have certification for, you know, wood products. So timber that's come from, you know where the timber's come from and it's tracked, and you know, where it's been logged from, and you can basically trace that back to where it's come from, and you can get a certificate, some sort of certification, so that you know that that's legitimate timber. You ought to also be able to do that, although there are moves afoot at least to try and developed systems to do that for biofuels, so that you've got the full greenhouse gas and energy balance, and you know exactly how much has gone in to get the energy out with the end product.
We're talking with Dr. Pete Smith of the University of Aberdeen, and we're talking about a Greenpeace report called Cool Farming, Climate Impacts of Agriculture and Mitigation Potential. You can download a quick summary or the whole report for free from the Greenpeace website at greenpeace.org. Pete, what would you like to add? What should people who've never really thought about farming and the climate take home from this new report?
Okay, well, the first thing is that I think we've had a lot of interest in that people didn't realize that farming contributed quite so significantly to climate change and greenhouse gas emissions. So the first thing to take away is that climate change does have a significant impact. But I wouldn't like people to go away with the idea that, you know, this report is a farmer bashing report, because it's not. You know, we need to eat. We need to feed a growing population. It's really aimed at making sure that the government incentives are correctly targeted towards efficient production of agricultural products, and not overproduction or some other way which sort of gives perverse outcomes in terms of the climate. So a lot of best management practices could be adopted and should be encouraged that could help agriculture move forward in a more sustainable way in terms of the climate.
So I see sort of a double role here. I mean, the farmers certainly are a big part of it, but as you say, government subsidies and government regulations, but also consumers. We can make some choices that can help farming be more climate friendly.
That's right, we can. I mean, at the moment, you look on anything that you buy in the supermarket, and you can see how many calories it's got in, and you can see the breakdown of the, you know, the fat and the carbohydrates and all of those sorts of things. Maybe in the future, at some stage, we may be looking at how energy intensive or how greenhouse gas friendly a certain product is. So if you started looking at that in terms of, you know, per kilogram of product that you buy in the supermarket, how much impact has that had on the climate? You might, you know, some form of labelling may be useful to help consumers decide. And of course, you know, there's still free choice out there. You can decide maybe to treat yourself once a week or twice a week to something that's, you know, not so good for the climate, and balance that up against you know, changing maybe to alternative products which are more friendly to the climate. That will probably lead to changes in at least awareness, which would then allow people to make choices based not just on their food preferences, but also on the climate impact of the foods that they consume.
Well, I love that idea. Dr. Pete Smith, thanks so much for talking with us today.
Thanks, Alex.
You can get an easy summary of the report, or the whole thing, free, from the Greenpeace website at greenpeace.org. Of course, only people who eat food should bother with it. This is Radio EcoShock, and we're examining the way industrialized agriculture is adding to climate instability. We'll be right back with more on the new Greenpeace report, Cool Farming. Well, we're looking at this new Greenpeace report on climate and agriculture, and it seems to me that North America must play a big role in the production of greenhouse gases as we grow food. And Americans and Canadians, we all know, like a lot of meat and use lots of petrochemicals for industrial-style agriculture. And we have Josh Brandon with us, an agriculture campaigner for Greenpeace based in Vancouver. Hi, Josh.
Hi, Alex.
Well, so what can farmers do to reduce the impact of agriculture on our climate?
Well, one of the problems with agriculture here in Canada is that it's highly industrialized, uses lots of fertilizer, lots of pesticides, and fertilizer in particular is one of the biggest contributors to greenhouse gas emissions globally, and it's a big problem here in Canada. Our report estimates that around the world, fertilizer usage causes over 17, somewhere between 17 and 32% of all human-induced greenhouse gas emissions. Here in Canada, we figure that figure is about 10%. And that's a big contribution when you look at the fact that Canada is one of the worst polluters overall in terms of greenhouse gas emissions around the world. So farmers can do a number of things to help this. They can cut back on their fertilizer usage. more targeted fertilizer use rather than broad-based fertilizer usage. Also important is using cover crops so that you're not having erosion and soil depletion.
Well, I know that, public perceptions are that governments don't play a big role in farming, but they do. There are so many subsidies and regulations, you wonder if some crops in the United States in particular would even be grown without the big government money behind it. So what kind of policy changes can governments make to reduce this climate impact?
Well, we need to stop subsidizing unsustainable environmental practices. The biofuel sector, it's very heavily industrialized, heavily dependent on fertilizers and dependent on subsidies. And that's not a solution for climate change. We need to have policies in place that'll help farmers get off the track of industrial farming, move to less intensive fertilizer regimes, and support local and sustainable farming practices, because that's where the future of farming is here. If we can switch to increasing research on organic farming, that would help a lot of farmers switch to using less fertilizer and using more sustainable practices.
Well, I think the idea is that as the population grows, we'll just keep using more and more fertilizer, but this report pretty clearly shows that we can't do that, even if we could. I mean, we also have the problem of peak oil coming along, so the amount of fertilizer won't be available. It surprised me in the report to notice that about 50% of what farmers put on the fields just gets wasted, goes out into both our atmosphere and our water. So surely they can target better what they do use.
Well, if you look at Lake Winnipeg, you can reach your arm in there and pull out an armload of algae that's created by excess fertilizer usage, both on farms and in the hog industry. And that's what doesn't go into the lakes goes into the air. And it robs the soil of nutrients to be continually over-farming the soil and being dependent on artificial fertilizers rather than replenishing the soil with natural methods of soil protection.
Yeah, and there's a lot in the report about farm animals causing greenhouse gases, especially methane, which is a powerful climate gas. And I worry that countries, will adopt Western-style agricultural technology and consumer products, and then maybe in India or China and many countries, they'll want to eat more meat just as we do. Do you see that happening? And if so, what could we do about that?
Well, Canadians eat more meat than most people around the world. North America generally it's a huge problem. And if people can switch to consuming less meat, also consuming more locally produced foods, that'll have a big impact on greenhouse gas emissions. But the main point in our report is that it's really up to governments to step forward and create a positive framework for sustainability rather than pushing the problem back onto farmers who are already struggling or onto consumers. Consumers have a role to play, but government needs to take the lead here.
Well, I agree with you there, and we've been talking with Josh Brandon of Greenpeace about this new report. It's called Cool Farming, Climate Impacts of Agriculture and Mitigation Potential. You can find it at their website at greenpeace.org. What else would you like to tell us about this report, Josh?
Well, this report is one of the first reports that really categorically goes through all the direct as well as indirect impacts of agriculture on climate change. It's a very thoroughly researched report by Pete Smith, one of the IPCC leaders and Nobel Prize winning scientists. So this is cutting edge research, and it really does show that agriculture is an important contributor to greenhouse gases and can be an important contributor to solving the problem if we choose sustainable policies.
Well, thanks so much, Josh Brandon from Greenpeace in Vancouver. In this first half hour of Radio EcoShock, we interviewed IPCC author Dr. Pete Smith and Canadian agricultural campaigner Josh Brandon about the Greenpeace report, Cool Farming. Find out more at greenpeace.org.